Our first case is, this morning is case number 68660, Clark County Deputy Marshals Association versus Clark County. Daniel Marks and Lawrence Van Dyke. Mr. Marks. Best thing to start off with, this, of course, is the issue of jurisdiction.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm here with Mr. Levine, and this is the third time that we're really arguing the issue of are the Clark County Deputy Marshals court or county employees. And if you recall 2 years ago during the argument on the Ron, we're calling the Ron Fox, that he had all the same parties, the Chief Justice said the marshals really need to know their status. Are they court or county employees? So we're hoping that we'll get a decision on the merits today. You, in your order on Thursday, you asked that we discuss the procedural issue. So the court had remanded the matter to Judge Maddox, who handled the appeal, the petition for judicial review of the MRB decision. And we had an evidentiary hearing last November, later to the day, before Judge Maddox, with support staff personnel. People actually did the mailing, attorneys, an evidentiary hearing. Judge Maddox, after hearing all the evidence, including from the support staff on both sides of the case, determined, one, that us as counsel for the CCDMA never got notice of the order. Number two, the order was actually mailed 4 days prior to the notice of entry, meaning it was filed 4 days later. And three, that we rebutted the presumption of the mailbox rule. So he concluded that the appeal was filed timely because after notice of entry that we received, we filed it within the 30 days. Now, what I think is important procedurally is the opponents did not file a writ, they did not file an appeal of special order. Most importantly, they did not file a Rule 27B motion. Your rules require that when you issue a procedural order reinstating the briefing schedule, they would have had a window of time before briefing to file a motion to alter, amend, or change it under Rule 27. They didn't do that. In fact, they actually signed the order of Judge Maddox approving as to form and content. So I believe they're accepting Judge Maddox's conclusion that our appeal was timely, and since they did not contest it until their answering brief, they've waived it under Rule 27. I'd like to get to the substance, if I may.
Sure.
On the substance issue, there's a separation of powers issue, which I think is the most important, and then the Chapter 3 issue. On the separation of powers, obviously Nevada is set up like the federal system of three co-equal branches of government. Marshals are Category 1 peace officers now. You may have been in the old days, they weren't, but they are now Category 1 peace officers. As Category 1 peace officers, they are, under your prior decisions of Galloway, executive branch employees. They can't be judicial branch employees. The court doesn't have a private police force. We've cited cases from around the country, from New Jersey all the way down to Arkansas and Mississippi. The Mississippi Lewis case is directly on point. The Mississippi Supreme Court concluded that their bailiffs were executive branch employees. If you go to Chapter 3, we celebrated last week, I think, the 153rd birthday of the state. Chapter 3 is one of the original chapters setting up the system of government. The legislature, in passing Chapter 3, creating district courts in the 1880s, set up a system where state court judges, district court judges, are elected and essentially are state judicial employees. But the legislature allowed the day-to-day administration of justice to be set down on the counties. So the judicial districts, like the 8th, encompasses Clark County. So when you read Chapter 3, the system of government is that state-elected judges, presumably in the 1880s, would be riding horseback into Clark County. And the county is required by statute to provide the facilities. Now it's a regional justice center. That is a county-owned building. They are to provide the fuel, the stationery, and the attendance. The state made a conscious decision to not provide that from the state budget. but to have the counties and the county commission provide that funding. The marshals are paid by Clark County. They're trained by Clark County. Their job description is in the Clark County Code. If something in that building breaks, if there's no power or electricity or air conditioning, you would get a county maintenance person.
Mr. Marks, I don't think any of that's in dispute. I think everything you said we would agree with. I guess the issue is we know in Clark County there's two types of marshals, the ones assigned to the district court judges specifically, who are selected by the district court judges, and district judges generally control the hours and their schedule, and the administrative bailiffs who report to court administration. I don't think county has any supervision over them, so how do we deal with that? It's done completely by the court.
Well, under Chapter 3, again, that the legislature made these decisions, the judge can choose two county service. The statutory scheme is the judge can choose. In other words, as a district court judge, you would be able to choose your judicial marshal. But they are then appointed to county service. Just as if you're in court clerk, you may have some choice of your in court clerk, but we know those are county employees and actually are under an SEIU bargaining agreement. In the second judicial district, the bailiffs or marshals can be working for a judge, yet they're under a collective bargaining agreement and they're county employees in Washoe County. So there's nothing inconsistent because the legislature hasn't created different types of marshals. That dichotomy is something.
So you're saying the control issue by the judges or court administration is irrelevant. It's who pays their salaries and then provides their benefits and all is what controls.
Well, as for 288, you have day-to-day control just like in the federal system. The federal U.S. marshals are executive branch employees, but a judge, if you were a federal judge, you could certainly direct day-to-day decision making. It's in corporations and government all the time. A supervisor can direct day-to-day activities. The issue here is under 288. 288 says any employee of a local government employer is a local government employee. It says any. We know that you're a strict constructionist and generally look to the legislature. The word any is all encompassing. The legislature, for instance, said the only exceptions to 288 would be doctors, which doesn't really apply. Interestingly enough, civil DAs are excluded from 288, but criminal DAs are not excluded, and therefore they have a collective bargaining agreement. Public defenders have a collective bargaining agreement. They certainly take direction from other people in the court system, but under 288, they're included. Confidential employees that are involved in the CBA itself and supervisors. When the legislature only excluded those four categories, that would normally include everything else. You have followed that Latin expression, something excluded by name means the others would be included. So therefore, the marshals were never excluded by the legislature, they would normally be included. I don't think the day-to-day authority issue implicates 288. You would certainly be able to tell your marshal, just like you would tell your clerk, the supervisory issues that you would have to tell them. But for instance, the marshals do more than just work for an individual judge. In time of emergency, if there was an emergency in the courtroom, terrorist attack, shooting, they would have to operate to protect the whole building, the public, and other judges. And I think that's the point.
Mr. Marks, do we have to separate out the 55 marshals that are attached to the judges?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Do we have to separate out the 55 marshals who are assigned to judges?
No, I'm saying you don't because...
Why not?
Okay, because under 288...
I'm looking at 288. 288.060 sub 1 sub 2 provides a five-part test for employment in terms of looking at supervision, wages, right to hire and fire, the right to control hours and location and extent, to which the worker's activities further the general business concerns of the alleged employer.
So, for instance, a judicial marshal is not a judicial marshal for a contract for all time. They could work for an individual judge. If a judge was dissatisfied, they could be sent back down to the administrative pool, and you can choose another marshal to become a judicial marshal. It doesn't change the fact their PERS is paid for by the county. Their workers' comp is paid for by the county. Their EEO issues.
Isn't there a management agreement between the courts and the county in terms of supervision of personnel and those kinds of things?
There are interlocal agreements. But I think the issue, the judges won't be giving up any authority if you rule that they're local government employees.
For the judicial marshals, is there a pool created and the judges just have to hire out of that pool? Or do the judges directly hire their judicial bailiffs?
The judges have historically hired, but, excuse me?
A faux pas, I still refer to them as bailiffs.
Right. So in the prior years, historically, judges could hire who they wanted. I think there's a recognition because of the skill needed now to be post-1 certified. The fact that
it could not be administrative marshals, bailiffs, work in the court system unless they were certified and they had a year from employment beginning to get certified at one point. That might have changed.
It's changed in the sense that they're now post-1. They used to be post-2. So being post-1, I think there's a recognition in the courthouse that, let's say there was an attack on a judge, a terrorist attack. It's not just one bailiff or marshal protecting one judge. You're protecting everybody that's in that building, which includes county employees, it includes the public, it includes municipal court, district court. The Supreme Court was there for a while. The duties have expanded beyond just the one-to-one marshal to judge situation. And there's no distinction. Somebody doesn't take a test to become a judicial. It's not a different classification. It's a different job description or duty, and that can be changed. So there's nothing inconsistent with Chapter 3 or Chapter 288. If the legislature was going to exclude a category, you would normally defer to the legislature. Now, if something happened where the court wasn't getting everything they needed, Chapter 3 provides that the judge can contact the sheriff, get what they need, and bill it to the county. So you have built-in protection in Chapter 3 to get everything you need.
In the case of Clark County, the sheriff is out of the picture, and has been out of the picture for some time. At one point, they were authorized and they were signed off by the sheriff.
Right.
That's no longer the case.
Right. Since 2007, but that statute is a statute relating to local government. Chapter 3 still provides, if the county was going to freeze you out in the winter and not provide fuel, if they didn't provide the employees you needed, if they didn't provide air conditioning, you can follow Chapter 3, contact the sheriff, and it's billed through the Clark County Commission. That law is still on the books and is still good law since probably 140
years. Is that
applicable
in Clark County as we presently sit and for purposes of this case?
Excuse me?
Is that applicable in Clark County for the purposes of this case?
Right, it's still good law in this case.
Is it being followed in Clark County? They're not under the control of the marshal, of the sheriff. Right?
There haven't been problems as far as this record where judges haven't gotten the facilities they needed. That's if somebody didn't get the facilities they needed. Judges are getting the facilities they need. They're getting the employees they need.
Well, that may be, from your standpoint, I think the court might differ.
I mean, from the record below. But the issue is, Chapter 288 in collective bargaining isn't going to change that, because under the Pennsylvania model that we've proposed, the county has an obligation to protect the judge's interest, and if they don't, you have recourse to the county. I'd like
that's
to reserve
consistent with the constitutional mandate too.
And Chapter 3, yes.
Yeah.
Can I reserve remaining, because I only have 42 seconds?
I'm going to give you 3 minutes, and I'm going to give Mr. Van Dyke 18 minutes total.
Okay.
I'll give you an extra 3 minutes.
Thank you, and I'll answer any other questions. Justice Douglas, sir.
I think save it for rebuttal, Mr.
Okay, then I'll save it for
rebuttal. Mr. Van Dyck, I'm going to give you the extra 3 minutes at this time, so you'll have 18 minutes. And if you would talk about the jurisdiction, then go into the merits.
I'm sorry.
If you would talk about the jurisdiction, then go into the merits, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Lawrence Van Dyck on behalf of respondents. I'll be presenting on behalf of all the respondents this morning, but Yolanda Givens from Clark County is at counsel's table. So if you have a question that's Clark County specific or too hard for me to answer, then feel free to direct it to her.
Well, we're fortunate because I have two former chief judges of the Clark County of the 8th Judicial District Court and a former civil district attorney.
So I'll start with
some jurisdiction. We've got some heavy hitters up here today.
I'll start with jurisdiction this morning, Your Honor. As undoubtedly you're aware, this court remanded the case on limited remand to the district court in order to decide. If you read the order of limited remand, it looks to me like, I'm not going to tell you what you guys meant in your order, but it looks to me like you're asking one question, and that is, was this thing actually mailed on July 9th, like had been said? And the court answered that question. It did do a factual finding and said...
Well, there's a problem even with that, though. Your certificate of service said it was mailed a year earlier.
Right.
You want to kind of rule book on this. It seems to me that you have a defective certificate of service on a pretty important document right out of the chute. It said it was mailed July 9th, 2014, when in fact, even if you accept the district court judge's findings, it was mailed a year later.
Right.
That to me is problematic, and I also don't see any discussion of 58 NRCP 58E, which addressing notices of entry, which is a peculiar Nevada rule, talks about as if the two need to be served and filed together on the same day. I get that Rule 5 and whatever the appellate rules contemplate, you can file a reasonable time after service, but 58 on notice of entry talks about within 10 days after entry of a judgment, the party who's serving notice of entry shall serve it and shall file the notice of entry with the clerk of the court, and it's within the same 10 days after the judgment's entered. So I have some real concerns about the timeliness issue and those 2 points that weren't vetted by the district court particularly. I get that the district court said it was a clerical error on your office's part.
Right. So on the first point, I think the district court said it was a clerical error. I think this court recognizes clerical error. Now, if the court wants to say that a clerical error, that I think everybody recognizes this as a clerical error. So I guess if the court wanted to say that that kind of clerical error knocks out a certificate of service, I don't think it should, but I mean, that's something this court would. But the second point I can address, I think, healthfully. So the second issue, both the filing and the service happened within the 10 days, because under this court's rules, the 10 days would end on the 15th. Keep in mind, 4th of July was in the middle there. So if you run the numbers, at least as I ran them, it ends on the 15th.
Okay.
And the reason you have different dates, you have to keep in mind that our office in Las Vegas was the one that was filing this, and we regularly, and this happens, you know, especially a state like Nevada that has county, you know, spread out, our office mailed it the same day. So they mailed it on the 9th. To the opposing party and to the court to file it, but it just didn't arrive. And then it went over the weekend. The 9th was either Thursday or Friday. It went over the weekend, and then that Monday, the 13th. So that's why you have a date discrepancy there. They were both mailed, and it just comes about because the rules say that service is effective upon mailing, whereas filing, I presume, I guess, is effective upon receipt. And so, but in any event, one nice thing about this case is that, from my perspective, is that they're all within the 10 days. And there's nothing in that rule, that the Rule 55, whatever you're saying, that says that they have to be done on the same day. It just says they have to be done within the 10 days. And so, and that, I want to point out, is what distinguishes this case from all of the cases that were cited by counsel, the Montana cases and the two Dakota cases that were cited. In all of those cases, the Montana cases use the word file in some place, but they use the word service in other places. The Montana rule uses the word service. And the court, when it actually talks about what matters is service, the reason they use the word file in some of those cases, I think they were using the word file and service basically to mean the same thing, just the same way Judge Pickering, that you were kind of used it. You were saying that the rule seems to contemplate both happening. And to be clear, they did happen at the same time here. It's that differential of the fact that when you mail it to the court, it takes a couple
of days. It's just of concern to me because you do have, the certificate of service was defective. It was off by a year. I appreciate the need for certainty in this area, but it's worrisome to me that it comes, it's filed 4 days after. We don't have electronic service in the first judicial, or we didn't at the time. a person who looked at it would see on the docket sheet whenever it was filed, if they looked up the docket sheet.
Right, so the defective service, the fact that it had this clerical error, I don't know what I can say that of it. I mean, it obviously had a clerical error. I can't say there wasn't a clerical error.
And
I don't think
the
clerical error.
But as a matter of fact, the trial judge resolved that issue.
And said, and I think that's right, Your Honor. So I guess what I'm saying, though, is I suppose this court could say, even though he resolved it and made sure that it was only a clerical error and that everything else was fine, that I suppose this court could say clerical error knocks it out. I don't think this court should. But I mean, I don't have a whole lot more to say to this court as to whether or not. But I can address some of the other things I think you just touched on, which is, you know, basically their argument comes down to a fairness objection. They're saying, you know, if we don't ever receive it, how can you, you know, how can it be predicated on service, be predicated on mailing, like is under this court's rule, if we don't ever receive it? And I get that argument. I think it's a particularly weak argument in this context, because in this context, you actually receive the order from the court. So the court serves the order. And so it's not like they don't know that they're going to have, that they have an adverse decision that they're going to need to appeal from. The only thing they don't know when they receive that order from the court is it going to be 33 days from receiving that order in the court, which would be the very shortest it could be if we were really on the ball and sent out our notice like that day, or is it going to be 33 days plus a few days? So it's not like a counsel can't protect themselves under the rule as has been traditionally understood under this court's like Luke case, and I think under what I would call a textual reading of the rules. First of all, they can protect themselves by filing a notice of appeal within 33 days of getting the order. I mean, that's one way to check. The other way they protect themselves is to check the docket. And here, it's undisputed that if anybody had checked the docket up to a month before that August 13th date, which is the deadline if you go off of the 9th, if they checked it up to a month before, July 13th, it was filed. So that's all anybody has to do. They get the order from the court. If they're worried about lost mail, now there's the risk of lost mail. This isn't that as big of a risk here, because it's not like you can't protect yourself from that. I do want to compare that to what will be the case, I'm afraid, if this court goes with the rule that they're asking for. You call it the equitable notice when received rule. The problem with that, I think, is threefold, Your Honors, and that is changing to a proof of receipt rule, number one, means you're going to have a lot more factual disputes when something like this happens. You're going to have the district court having to decide a factual dispute. Was it received or was it not received? But worse than that, that's a really difficult factual decision for a court to make. I mean, if there was ever a case where you would say you did, I mean, the problem is they're going to say we didn't receive it, and how can you ever disprove that if you're the other party? You can't. In fact, we have the best case you'd ever have. Clark County can wave their and say, we got it. We got it the next day on the 10th. And so the problem, I think, is that if you change to a proof of receipt rule, then every time a notice of appeal is filed late and somebody says they didn't receive it, essentially the rule's out the window, because you can't disprove that they didn't receive it. So you're kind of creating a rule that's very difficult to administer. And lastly, and this says nothing about the parties in this case, but of course this court is concerned not just about the parties in this case, but about what its rules will do going forward. And that is, you're creating a very strong incentive for what is going to happen to a counsel who blows the deadline because they did receive it, but they blew the deadline? They're going to have to have a malpractice.
What do you say to their argument that, right or wrong, it was determined by whichever justice signed the order saying?
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a legal. So he decided factual findings like this court ordered him to do, but he went on and decided a legal finding that it was timely. And the legal timing is, I mean,
no,
this court.
This our prior order. Our order that it appears to be. And yes, exactly.
Okay, gotcha. I'm sorry.
Their point is that we have rules that require some objection to that, and there was none made, and therefore that became final, and we should not be reexamining it.
Well, it certainly doesn't block this court from being mistaken. It's black letter law, not just the court, but every court. The court always has the ability to look back at its jurisdiction, make sure it has jurisdiction. And the concerns that I'm raising with the court now, I think, should cause the court to make sure that if it is going to effectively change the rule from a notice of from a serve when the date starts when served to the date starts when served, but only if you receive it rule, which would be a change, I think, Your Honors. And if the court's going to make that change, then I think this court, it's incumbent upon this court to decide whether or not it has jurisdiction. So this court certainly isn't blocked from deciding whether it has jurisdiction, even if we were.
So there's another option. You could say that a reasonable rule is when you're serving something as important as a notice of entry, and you're the victorious party, filing needs to be before or at the time of service.
Well, keep in mind, Your Honor, I think the problem with that, as a practical matter, in Nevada.
I agree with you. It would be a bad rule to say it's always measured by whether or not you've got it, because that would just...
The problem with the rule that Your Honor just said is that in Nevada, that would mean we could no longer mail file something from our southern office, for instance, in the AG's office to the north, because that's what happened. Remember, they sent it out the same day. They sent out all three documents, the document to Clark County, the document to these guys, and the document to the court was all sent out the same day. It just turns out that these two parties are down south, so Clark County got it one day later on Friday, but it had to go over the weekend, and so they received it on the 13th. So the problem with that is you would actually, in order to act, that rule I think is completely inadministrable, because you'd actually have to you'd be forced to hand file. With the AG's office, I guess we can send a runner, from our northern office, but that's going to make it really hard for people.
Mr. Randbeck, I know we've got some other issues, and I'm specifically interested in this Chapter 288 argument Mr. Marks made, and basically his analysis and interpretation. What's your position on that?
So the three-factor test, I think the first place to start there is this court's five-factor test in Clark County from NRS 288. I think they don't really, I don't see them as making a strong argument that those factors actually favor them. The only factor that favors them is the wages, the source of the wages factor. And I want to point out to the court, I don't even think that factor very strongly favors employment in this context for two reasons. One is, keep in mind, as this court's Sparks case and its Azura case and Young case all make clear, it's not like the Clark County, in setting these wages, has unfettered discretion to set the wages. They have to set the wages at a level, when they're dealing with judicial branch employees, that do not interfere with the judiciary's ability to. So they couldn't set the wages so low that you couldn't hire security, for instance, any more than the legislature here could set the wages for your court bailiff personnel so low that you couldn't find anybody that would serve. And so I think actually the wages, and because of that, and also just because of the fact that in government, wages are often set by another branch. I'm obviously an employee of the Attorney General's office, the executive branch. But my wages are set by the legislative branch, or at least my wage range. And that doesn't make me a legislative branch employee. My wages, I think, I don't know for sure because I don't actually get checks, but I think my wages are paid by the Comptroller's office, not by the Attorney General's office. That doesn't make me a Comptroller's office employee. In other words, wages in government are often paid by another branch, or set by another branch, or paid by another branch. So it's a particularly weak factor. So I don't think the five-factor test, I think, is very straightforward that these are, and I think that the board's decision on that, even if it wasn't due any deference from this court, which I think it is, but even if it wasn't, it would be clearly right. Instead, what they're really doing is saying, we want you to judicially impose a dual-employer bargaining model. And they point to these other states. And I do want to point out, again, I think they're misusing, just like they're misusing states, I want to make sure something's clear about what I was saying earlier real quick. When I talk about the Montana cases and the Dakota cases, all those cases, they never even filed or served the documents in those cases. That's what the court was concerned. It wasn't a deal with, you didn't do something. They didn't even serve at all. But so in here, it's a similar type misuse, I think, of these other states' cases. I think it's really helpful. I want to point this out to the court. They cite these Pennsylvania and Mississippi cases, and they say, first they call it a Washington model, but then later they call it a Pennsylvania model. They ask this court here's the issue in the Pennsylvania and Mississippi cases. There, the legislature, if you look at the read those cases, and I would direct this court to the Bradley case out of Pennsylvania, 1978 case. The legislature there very clearly in Pennsylvania said, we want judicial branch employees as judicial branch employees to collectively bargain. And then they went even farther and they said, but we want the county to represent them, as sort of like the judicial branch is sort of represented. That is not at all what's happening. In other words, those states had a very thorny separation of powers issue because the legislature actually stepped in, and it's not, they're not even arguing that here. They're saying that these are kind of like partially local government employees. They're not saying that these are, this would be like if the legislature said, we want the Nevada Supreme Court's bailiffs as judicial branch employees to have to collectively bargain. Then you guys would have a hard case. You'd have to decide whether separation of powers required. That's not, so the Pennsylvania cases and the Mississippi cases, very different circumstance where the legislature very clearly wanted them to bargain as judicial branch employees. They say nothing about whether or not you should create a dual model like you talk.
So what is the impact of the interlocal agreement signed between the, I think it's the Chief Judge of the 8th Judicial District Court and Clark County, and through the Clark County Commissioners, what impact does that contract have on this case?
Here's how I think it works. I think there's three different ways you could come down on separation of powers. I think you could say, judicial branch employees can never be managed or paid or anything by other branches. Obviously, that can't be right. Second JD has bailiffs that, you know, 8th JD did until they changed in 2007. The Harvey case, this court made clear that you can have, essentially, I think it got it right, and what it's saying is you can farm out. You know, this court tomorrow could say, I'd like our bailiff, just wearing us out, the security thing, have to manage all these bailiffs. We'd like to either, like, independently have some independent non-government entity do it, or we'd like to maybe even try to have DPS do it. We'll ask the legislature to take that out. I think this court can do that if it voluntarily does that. Now, the separation of powers doesn't prevent this court from being able to farm something out, but the issue here is the 8JD doesn't want to do that. I think that's why that leads right into the Washington case that they talk about. You know, they talk about they want the Washington model. You know what the Washington model is? The Washington model is where, as the four-judge concurrence in the Washington Zelester case makes clear, the Washington model is where the court says, you know what, we like this. We want this. Which is not what the 8JD has done. And the Washington model is not imposing it upon court. The Washington model is the court saying, yeah, we like this, you know, I don't know why, but maybe they say, we don't like managing our own employees. Just like this court could say, we'd like to contract out any aspect up to a certain point, I suppose. You probably can't contract out your jobs, but you can contract out, you know, a lot of the aspects of it. And that's the Washington model, I think, is critical. If you read the four justice concurrence, they only join the court's, and by the way, one of the justices in this four justice concurrence is in the five judges justice majority, so I actually think this might be the binding aspect of the case. But they say without this approval, the court's approval, there would be a violation of the separation of powers law. So that the Washington model is completely inapplicable here because I think we're very clear, given the HAD's position, they want to manage these employees. They want to manage them. And so that's, I think they should be their employees. So I think it's easy to get into an idea that we need to be at one extreme or the other. You can't ever have employees, kind of Reed Galloway really strongly say, you can't ever have judicial branch employees work outside of the, you know, sort of managed by anybody else. Obviously, you can do that because we've got sheriff's deputies in all the courts except for the HJD serving as security, and this court said in Harvey that you can have county clerks serve as court clerks at the court's discretion. That's not right. The other extreme is you can force a court. You can force a court, and this court makes clear in Sparks that you can't force a judicial branch to basically give up management of its employees, including marshals. It uses the word marshals. The right answer, I think, is in the middle, which is a court can do that, but only if they want to do that. They can acquiesce it. And here, and that's what, by the way, that's what the Zelester case is, too, so it's not even on point with what's going on here. And here, just like in the Sparks case, the HJD says they don't want to do that. They say they don't want to do that. So it's just a very different case, Your Honor. So I guess I would urge the court to uphold the board's decision, I think, is correct. And I don't think we actually have a difficult separation of powers issue because of the way it's in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Bender.
Thank you.
Ms. Brown, will you set the clock at 3 minutes and 42 seconds for Mr. Marks? 3:42.
Mr. Chief Justice. Justice Sotis, I want to...
Hold on for a second. We're setting the clock.
Oh, sorry.
3:42. Okay,
thank you. Justice Sotis, I want to try to respond with more clarity to your question. In 2007, the sheriff was relieved of the responsibility of sitting in each court session, but the statute passed by the legislature did not change the status other than the name. They became marshals instead of bailiffs, and we all sometimes still call them bailiffs. And that act said an act relating to local government. You may not realize that under NRS 3310, that set up the system of district court judges and their attendants, the attendants, the facilities, and the people that help you in the court. It says if the judges, you have the right to appoint a bailiff marshal, but if the judges cannot agree, or if you didn't do it, the county commission would appoint someone for you. So I think the fact that you can control the day-to-day activities, you can tell them what to do, doesn't change the fact that they're local government employees, both supported by Chapter 3, if you analyze how we got district courts and the people that help you do your job as district court judges, and 288. There's nothing inconsistent. In fact, it's very consistent. Now, if there was collective bargaining, there might be a category of judicial marshals that would be different than administrative. It might have different duties. It might have different responsibilities. It might have different pay. Right now, in the Clark County Code, there's only really one job description and pay scale, and that's marshal. And then the judges day-to-day control those marshals. So when we call them judicial marshals, they're not really a separate category as the system is set up. Also, obviously, in the Second Judicial District in the Devine case, you acknowledge that they were county employees, and I believe they have collective bargaining. So there's nothing inconsistent. And in terms of, there isn't reported cases where district court judges need employees or need staff or need things, at least in reported cases or in the MRB record in this case, where they're not able to get them. What I'm pointing out is you don't have to go to a city of Sparks. In footnote 5, you said we're not dealing with that issue. You don't have to get there because you have statutory authority to get fuel, stationery, attendance, equipment, supplies. For instance, if they didn't provide adequate facilities, you have recourse through Nevada statute to get the facilities you need and bill the county. So therefore, all of those arguments suggest that these marshals are 288 employees. And what we're asking the court to do is remand to the MRB for remedy with the determination that the marshals by statute are 288 employees because they were not excluded. It's a very simple argument. If the legislature wanted to exclude them, they clearly wanted to exclude them. The separation of powers argument gives you more authority that a post-certified Category 1 peace officer would not be employed by a court system, would be employed by an executive branch. So I think that should hopefully solve your issue of your day-to-day control is not inconsistent. And in the corporate world or in government, there's also line authority where you could have a chain of command for security services up a line authority, but still have dotted line authority to the person directly in control. You obviously are directly in control in your courtroom, just as the federal judge.
Thank you, Mr. Marks.
Am I out of time now?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Court thanks Mr. Marks and Mr. Van Dyke for your arguments and briefs in this matter and the challenging issues that you've raised. This matter will stand.